So good afternoon, everyone. So I'm Astrid Lambertz. I'm a postdoc at Caltech. But before that, I was a postdoc working with Phil at UWM, and this is where I joined the Blazer Heating Group. So I will actually be talking about something that Christoph has not mentioned in his talk, the idea that blazer heating is maybe not uniform. And if you go beyond this first assumption, there is a bit more wiggle room into the explanations of the IGM observations. So you've already seen most of this. People have convinced you that we care about the IGM. It's the majority of the variance is in there, so it really is the reservoir for structure formation. And the other interesting thing about the intergalactic medium is that it has a very good memory of thermal injections. So it really acts as a calorimeter. And so if we understand it well, within a certain extent, we can have an idea of reionization, but also other energy injections, such as those resulting from star formation or AGN. The relatively easy thing about the intergalactic medium, and I used to say easy, but it's really relatively easy, not totally easy, is that it's, because it's low density, it can be understood rather well with a quasi-linear view. It's very easy to understand, and it does not have a lot of nonlinear physics. So the basic view of thermal history, so this is supposed to point.
You need to pull out the little
This?
Yep.
And then where do I push?
Just pull it.
Okay. So people have already mentioned the basics of the thermal history of the intergalactic medium. So really, it's a battle between heating and cooling. And in most of the views, it is cooling that wins. So what happens for a patch at mean density of the universe? It was reionized at some point. Current observations seem to favor that this happened somewhere between redshift 10 and redshift 6. But to be honest, this is still a work in progress. And then once reionization is done, if you're in a low-density region, recombination isn't really going to happen anymore, so the only thing you do is cooling down. And so this is what you see here. At some point, helium-2 also gets reionized. It typically happens around redshift 3, but here again, there is some observational uncertainty. And then basically, the game is over if you're in an underdense region. You just cool down. And in the current universe, your temperature is probably a few thousand Kelvin. But this is actually something that is very hard to measure. So the basic picture of the thermal history here is that we have the temperature of a given region in the IGM is set by some temperature at the mean density, T naught, and then determined by a power law if you have a different density. And so the questions are, what is this T naught and what is this gamma? But you may have understood already that A, T naught is probably not the best thing to use here because the mean density is something that we have trouble observing with the Lyman alpha forest. And gamma, using a gamma factor here, assumes that you have one unique power law here, and I will show you that maybe this is not the case. So coming back to some observational challenges, because we have this very low density medium, I mean, if this were the IGM, there would be 1,000 atoms in this room, typically. So you can only see it to absorption. And we mostly have the Lyman alpha forest, which works well at redshift beyond 1.5, because below that, we're in the UV regime, and you need to basically use HST to get your data. And typically, works well below redshift 3. We can go beyond that, but we just have less data. So we don't have a full history. Also, the Lyman alpha forest is sensitive to a density that is typically above the mean density. And if you want to look at lower density and have some constraints on blazer heating, you would ideally want to go to helium-2, but this is something that is observationally very challenging. Part of it also comes from uncertainties on ionizing background. I will not expand on this, but this is something that has recently been brought up. So what observers typically do is you have a spectrum, you fit your lines, and then you get a column density and a Doppler width for each line. And then from that, people typically infer a density and a temperature. But this is really not the same thing. So going from this So this requires you to calibrate your data with simulations. And that brings two problems. The first one is that any simulation has physical assumptions. So you will necessarily only probe the model that you put in. It will be very hard to make any prediction beyond what you put in your simulation. And then there's obviously numerical uncertainties, and resolution is the major caveat here. So this is just a compilation of most of the current status of the field, I would say. So T0, we start to have a reasonable agreement on what it looks like, but for gamma, really, we're still there's still a lot of room for improvement here. So this is all very interesting. Now let's go back to blazer heating. So the initial work that Avery, Phil, and Christoph did was saying, okay, we should have an inverted temperature density relation for the low density intergalactic medium. So at low density, I predict an upturn. And there was some observational evidence for this. So you see this is a fit to, this is fit to certain data, and it works well. And then slightly after that, more other papers came out, and this one is shows the Doppler width as a function of column density. And so the way this works is that the Doppler width of a line is set by a certain number of things. So first there's the thermal broadening, which is related to your temperature, which is what we care about. And then you have other effects such as turbulence and your Hubble flow. So the idea is that for a given column density, the lowest Doppler width that you can find is probably set by your temperature. So then the next thing to do is that for every, basically for every column density, you can find this lower envelope, and you can say that this is a proxy for your temperature density relation. So if you take this at face value, you find two opposite temperature density relations. So as I mentioned, and as other people have said, every observation and every analysis has its caveat and is sensitive, maybe sensitive to different things. So this is not necessarily a contradiction, but it has to be solved. So really the question is, what is the thermal state of the intergalactic medium, and is there some way to reconcile these two things? So I will, this is just coming back to the motivation. So we care about this because it's the basis for large-scale structure formation. It's reasonably easy to understand compared to other questions in galaxy formation. And we have, if we actually understand this well, we may have an idea of how many blazers we had in the first place, if we find that blazer heating actually works. And we could go beyond, we could go beyond the redshift z of 0.5 where we actually see them. We could actually know how many of them were there before. So I will first present the uniform heating models that Christoph presented and other people, and then I will go on to the impact of clustering. So as people have said, to the first approximation, the distribution of AGN is uniform, the extragalactic background light is uniform, so blazer heating should be uniform. As such, you highly privilege under a dense region because you have more heat per baryon. So if we look, this is temperature density relation of the baryons in the current universe. And so really we are looking at this panel. So we're under the mean density and at low temperature. We do not care about this warm, hot, shock heated intergalactic medium. And so really the scale that we care about here is set by the mean free path for the of the initial gamma ray photon. So it is inversely proportional to the energy of your gamma ray photon. So for low energy gamma rays at low redshift, you may go up all the way to a gigaparsec almost. And for higher energy, it's typically around a few tens of megaparsec. But this is large scale. It is typically way beyond other feedback mechanisms that people look at when they talk about AGN feedback. So really this is far away from your initial cluster or galaxy. So when did this happen? Really, the limit for blazer heating to work is set by the number of blazers, which is something we don't know at high redshift. So as has been pointed out this morning, there is some resemblance between the blazer luminosity, the local blazer luminosity function, and the local quasar luminosity function. So we can The assumption that we made is that blazars evolve like quasars at higher redshift. And if you do so, you end up with the following luminosity distribution that typically peaks around redshift 2. And basically, this is where we start to have most of the heating here. So what does this do to the temperature of the intergalactic medium? So remember, this is the initial, this is the basic assumption with no extra heating. And you see that if you basically add this blazar heating model into a basic model for the temperature evolution of the IGM, it's really just one equation you solve. You, depending on your blazar heating model, we have different flavors of it. The temperature in the current universe is about 10 times higher than what you would expect from an unheated model. And you see that anything below redshift 3 is significantly heated. So now looking at the temperature density relation, so this is the case when there is no heating. Basically, as time goes by, you only cool, and low density regions get colder and colder. So this is the traditional slope for the temperature density relation. Now, if you include our blazar heating model, then you get this progressive upturn. And so at this point, I still call it a temperature density relation, but later on, I will consider something more wide, and I guess we should rather use the term temperature density distribution. So this is work done by Ewald. This is actually looking at the result of a hydro simulation and looking at how this uniform blazar heating model impacts the intergalactic medium. So this is the probability distribution function of the temperature in his simulation. The dotted lines are no blazar heating, so it's typically cold, and it gets colder and colder as time goes by. And then the solid lines are the blazar heated cases. And you see as time goes by, the difference gets obviously larger and larger. But if you look now at the density probability distribution function, there's actually little difference between the heated and the unheated case. So this is mostly something impacting temperature, but not so much the actual structure of the intergalactic medium. So observationally, remember we are typically looking at an idea about T naught and some idea of this gamma, this sort of adiabatic index for the intergalactic medium. So there's this interesting result that shows you T delta as a function of redshift. So this delta here is a characteristic density at which the Lyman alpha forest is sensitive for a given redshift. So it is something that is low at high redshift and then gets progressively higher in the current universe. So it is not the mean density, but it is, we can rescale it to have some idea about what's going on at the mean density. And so the green points are the observational results. This, the blue line here would be a model for the intergalactic medium without any additional heating processes. And the three colored lines here are different models for blazar heating. This is just a low blazar heating model, and this is a very optimistic blazar heating model. And in this paper, there seems to be an indication of additional heat in the intergalactic medium at around redshift 2 that could be matched by a blazar heating model. And this I have shown you before. This is our inverted temperature density relation. Other interesting things are that also Ewald also looked at are the more detailed statistics of the Lyman alpha forest. So Martin showed this morning, this very interesting part of the PDF of transmitted flux fraction where you avoid this high transmission cutoff, and we can actually reproduce this part very well. You also, in this blazar heating model, you do not have to rescale your UV flux. So the unheated model here is the gray dashes, and what people typically have been doing is they see their transmitted flux, and then they rescale the UV flux to make sure that it matches here. But blazar heating model sort of avoids this caveat. And you have the same type of thing if you look at the power spectrum of your IGM. So this seems to work nicely. But then, yeah, we come back to this observation again. We had the first first few results that saying, okay, we heat the universe after redshift 3, we have an inverted temperature density relation, this works well, and then this observation comes up. So either there is some inconsistency here, or we have maybe some more wide distribution in the temperature density that could explain both of these observations. So here comes the part that hasn't been presented here yet, is the idea of a more patchy blazer heating. So if you just sit back and have a look at the intergalactic medium in the current universe, this is a very large scale simulation. It's a gigaparsec across, so we start to get into significant volumes. And you really see you have some very dense regions, big clusters, and you have regions where there is nothing on sizes of several tens of megaparsec. And so this really makes you think, okay, if I'm in the middle of this hole, this void here, maybe I won't get as much heating. Well, if I'm right here, there will probably be a lot of blazers, and I will probably get more heat. So the idea is really, okay, the closer I am to sources, the more heat I get. So I developed a model in which the heating rate is expressed as some median value, which is what we have already done, plus a fluctuation. And so the next part of the talk is just to how do we get this fluctuation and what does it actually mean? So the naive thing to do if you want to look at this fluctuation would be to say, okay, I have to find my blazer, so this means I have to trace black holes which merge, and then I have to know how in which accretion state they are to have the right type of jet, then I have to propagate my gamma rays, and then I have to see what's happening in the IGM. There is no way we're going to do this in a reasonable simulation. So what we did is mostly look at a more statistical method to have an idea of the heating rate depending on the local environment. So the idea is to relate the heating rate fluctuations to the local dark matter fluctuations. Because to a certain extent, the heating is related to the presence of sources, so it means galaxies, clusters, which is related to the presence of overdensity in the dark matter spectrum. So this is the assumption we have taken. And then if you want to know the heating rate at a given point, you just integrate over all the sources that can affect you. So this is the very simple case in a static universe, where I assume that dark matter and baryonic matter have the exact same behavior, which is not the case, but let's just start here. So the heating rate at a given point is just, the fluctuation is just the local value minus the average divided by the average. So really, I integrate over all the sources. This is the heat of each source, and then you decrease this by the mean free path, and there is the optical depth here. So this gives you some expression of the heating rate at a local point. And then there is a characteristic length scale that comes into play here, set by the mean free path of your gamma ray photons. So really, this is something that's basically an idea of filtering your heating. So this is naturally brings us to an idea of basically doing this in Fourier space and then switching back to real space. So this is what it actually looks like if you take into account many important things such as expansion of the universe and the fact that matter and dark matter are not exactly following this, are not exactly behaving the same way. So in this case, we still have an integral over the sources, so that hasn't changed. There is a correction here because the universe is expanding. There is also an integral on the distribution of the energy of the sources. And then this part is basically all the corrections we have to use to take into account the fact that dark matter and real matter don't cluster in the same way. So the green here is basically the linear growth of dark matter perturbations. So we have assumed it's linear, which is a reasonable assumption if you go into low density regions such as the IGM. This totally falls apart if you go into galaxies, for example. And this blue parenthesis translates how real matter clusters with respect to dark matter. And the thing you have to be careful about is this little b here. It's called the bias. So technically, the square of the bias is the ratio between the power spectrum of baryonic matter over the power spectrum of dark matter. And so this is something that can be, it's just a number that can be estimated observationally. It's small in the current universe, but it's probably of order 10 at redshift 5 for the most massive objects such as host galaxies for massive black holes. So this is basically the free parameter in our model. So So now if we look at this representation of this filter, so this is this filter as a function of wave numbers. So this is large scale and this is small scale. The first thing you see is that, okay, large scale strongly dominates. So a large scale dark matter over density will translate into a large scale region that has more heat than the average. On the other hand, small scale has no power. So a small dark matter over density will not translate in additional heat. Then now if we look at the values, so going from the dash, from the dotted line to the solid line, it's basically decreasing redshift. And decreasing redshift means increasing bias. And you just see that basically the normalization of this curve is set by the bias. It's just a translation between the clustering of real matter and dark matter. So basically the intensity of your heating fluctuation will be set by the value of your bias, more or less. And now, so if you look at the green versus the black curve, these are just two different bias models you don't have to worry about, but the idea is really the stronger your bias, the stronger your heating fluctuations will be. So this was implemented in Gadget, which is an SPH code that has been used a lot for cosmological simulation. This really, it's pretty simple because Gadget is already using an FF Fourier transforms to solve the Poisson equation for gravity. So you take your Fourier transform of your dark matter density field, you filter it, and you Fourier transform back, and this gives you your heating rate fluctuations. So it's an alternative to a subgrid model. It's computationally reasonably cheap. The major caveat here, though, is that because we have this filtering function, we need to make sure that we capture all the modes of the dark matter distribution, so we have to go to a large box to have a reasonable representation of a cosmological volume. So we took 100 megaparsec with a not so high resolution of 512 cube because we don't need to model star formation very well because we're looking at the intergalactic medium. So what it looks like, so this is redshift 3, redshift 1. These are slices of the density in the mid-plane of the simulation, and these are slices of the heating rate fluctuations. So just be aware, this is the log of density, while this has a linear scale. So you see that compared to your initial density fluctuations, your heating rate fluctuations are much smaller. We do not have orders of magnitude difference between heating rate. That's the first thing. The second thing you see is that underdense regions will receive less heat. So we have actually almost no heat in this region. And now if you look at an overdense region, typically you get more heat, which is what we expected naively. The other thing is that if you compare this line with this line, fluctuations are much higher at high redshift. This is just a translation of the bias, that you get higher bias, so higher heating rate fluctuations. So now if we look at the temperature distribution that this actually gives us, so remember the picture I showed before that Ewell made. So this is the volume weighted PDF as a function of temperature. So as time goes by, the average temperature decreases. And this, sorry. So if you look at the uniform heating case, this would be this one. The uniform heating case are the dotted lines that you may not see very well. So much. And then for different bias models, you see that you have a very wide spread here at low redshift. At redshift 1, there's basically two orders of magnitude between the coldest spot in the simulation and the warmest spot in the intergalactic medium. And so this has the potential to maybe reconcile certain observations that indicate that we are cold and certain that say that maybe we are a bit warm. So this is really the main result here. Okay, what the temperature density distribution, which really qualifies as a distribution now. So here you have different values for the redshift, and these are different models. So in the unheated case, you just keep this power low with low density gas being cold, and it doesn't really change much over time. Now, if you look at two bias models, so the bias in this case is slightly higher, so we'll focus on this one. You see that even at redshift 4, the coldest gas has not received any heat because it's far away from sources, and it's very much like the no heat case. But the warmest gas has received a lot of heat. It's basically 10 times warmer, And if you compare this to the uniform distribution at the same epoch, you see that really, you really see the scatter here. The warmest parts are have basically received way more heat, and the coldest part are reminiscent of this unheated case. So as time goes by, you see that this initial spread increases in the beginning. It's still the effect of the bias having a lot of wide distribution in the heat. And then at some point, every single region in the universe has been heated up by a blazer, which is consistent with the number of blazers we see now. And we find ourselves in this situation, where we're actually really close to the uniform case at redshift 1, because every single point has been warmed up. The spread is slightly larger. Some regions are slightly warmer. But on average, we fall back on our feet of the uniform heating case.
Each of your rows represents a no-heat, the galaxy bias, and the galaxy inquisitor bias included?
Yeah, so this is no heat.
Yes.
This is a galaxy bias model, and this is a quasar bias model. It's just that observationally, if we take typical galaxy, the bias value we find is slightly lower than if we look at quasar distribution. Because we don't have any idea about blazar bias, we figured we should look at both models and have some idea of the typical spread that this would give. But this is the main uncertainty. It's really to show you that this is the free parameter in our simulation, and we can basically tweak the knob a little bit to make it agree what we know. But we don't really know the value of the bias. It's worth mentioning that the quasar bias model is likely being favored, or is even maybe a lower limit to the actual spread, because there may be we didn't take into account anything like duty cycles or beaming effects, and that may be actually increase the scatter. So now coming back to our initial problem, this is very much a by eye fit, like a theorist's fit. But if we look at this distribution at redshift 2.4, which is the redshift at which most of this distribution is coming from, if you remember the uniform heating model, the lower envelope would be roughly here. Now, if we look at our model with fluctuations, we typically have a lower envelope around here. And this by eye looks like this. I agree, this is not exact science, and this has to be verified. But it seems to be going in the right direction. So this is actually what I've been working on more recently, is actually rerunning the simulations, because if you want to have an idea about the Lyman alpha first, you need more resolution than the initial simulations. And then you take your large simulation, you trace lines through it, then you can have you can compute transmitted flux and power spectra. You can fit the spectra, which is something I'm working on now, but it's not exactly doing what I expect, so I'm unfortunately not showing any results. And then you can compute your statistics, keeping in mind that different statistics are sensitive to different caveats, and that when comparing to observations, you should be really careful on how you do this. So I'm unfortunately not going to elaborate on this, but really what I hope you will remember is that the thermal history of the universe is really more complex than we expected. And so I have developed a model for inhomogeneous blazar heating. It really shows that blazar heating is not uniform at the redshift of 2 or 3. Small-scale fluctuations are erased, but large-scale fluctuations do remain. And so you get more heat if you're close to a large overdensity. And it's important to remember that unheated sources can remain cold for a long time. So we can keep this low temperature envelope for a long time. So this is obviously in the picture of blazar heating, but it's if we can confirm this with actually some comparison to observations, so this is what I'm doing now, analyzing the large-scale structure simulations, then we really can prove that it is possible to have a more complex model for heating into intergalactic medium. So I will compare with Lyman alpha data, but maybe in the future we will have some other probes. Helium, we may not have some data. 21 centimeter line, maybe there's chime. I'm in Canada, so I figure I should at least mention this. And then in the future, maybe we can either rule out blazar heating, or if it works, maybe have a handle on the blazar luminosity density as it evolves with redshift. And I'll leave it at that. Thank you very much.
We have some time for questions. So what have you assumed for the normal function?
Our background is Cauchy-Giguère model. And I've used the same thing that Ewald used, where I've slightly delayed the injection of photoheating by hydrogen reionization in the simulation, but I don't think this will change anything in my low redshift results. I've basically used Fauché-Giguère just to make comparison to certain other works more clear, but I'm not betting that this is the best thing to use.
One question that I had both from this and from the talks earlier this morning was, so I thought it was a great success at one point that you were able to reproduce the flux PDF of Lyman alpha without having to reset the continuum. I've now been told that's not true, but I would like to understand
you mean the diet is in background, right?
Yeah.
Because we don't know what it is.
Yeah.
The simulation just assumes something the way you measure it is from the line up before us by adjusting it so that it agrees.
But at the end of the day, it has to match up with sources, right?
So this is very messy astrophysics, but how many ions and photons make it up galaxies? The Nasty function of AGN. You can argue that within a factor of two, the sources seem like they can produce the background that we see. But the background you measure, the way you measure it is that you take your simulation and then you adjust the background until it has the same amount of absorption, mean absorption as the observations. Any comparison should do that adjustment before. So if you're comparing the flux PDF, then you first should adjust your simulation so that it has the same amount of transmission.
But as I said, predicting the emissivity from the sources is difficult. For quasars, you can probably do that with an factor of two or so. Because all the noisy functions have errors, extrapolate to the fainter ones. The reason you can do that for quasars is because we know how the quasars use ionizing photons, at least out of the bright ones can escape. For galaxies, we don't actually know how many photons escape.
Yeah.
Because of that, you have to look far into the UV, the flux drops. That's a very difficult measurement, and people argue by effect of a few. And normally they don't see the ionizing photons at all. So this is more sort of stipulated that actually ionizing photons escape from galaxies. So you turn it around and actually use how many you see to sort of infer what ionization rates actually is rather than trying to predict it from the sources.
Okay, so it's hopeless to predict.
It's not hopeless, but it's sort of I showed you this Hardy-Mordau model.
Yeah.
This is actually such a prediction.
Right.
But there's one of these three parameters that the people put in is an escape vector of galaxies. So they adjust even in this model, they adjust this so that afterwards you get the effective optical depths of the Lyman alpha for this time.
I thought there was one other measurement just directly from observation. I can't remember what it was, gamma minus 12 or something like that.
This is exactly what you do is you sort of
right.
You assume the density distribution from the simulations and then you infer the photonization rate you need to get the mean flux in the spectral line.
Okay, so that's
this
all.
This is the same as normalizing your UV background model to actually fit the effective optical depth. just phrasing it differently instead of a flux, you phrase it in terms of a photonization rate.